Many of the people who care about how food is grown in this country are anticipating a friendlier relationship with the new administration in Washington. But although President Obama has often said he would support better farm and rural policies, is there any real proof that he will? Joining us today as part of her regular series on the show is Ruth Reichel, editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine, along with Kim Severson, food writer for The New York Times. I'm very pleased to welcome you to the show.
Great Hello. To be here.
Hello.
Kim, people in the food world seem to be feeling very optimistic about the new Obama administration. Why is that? And do you think they have good cause for thinking that way?
People in the food world, I think, feel a larger movement happening around them, and they have for some time. There's an increase in farmers' markets, the quality of food that's happening in the home kitchen. There's just a sense that there's kind of the second food revolution in the air. So naturally, when someone like Obama comes along, everything he eats has been scrutinized. And, from the menus at his daughter's school, and people are like, well, this percentage of organic is required at that school. They have this kind of recycling program.
He loves to eat at Topolobampo in Chicago.
This must mean that he is our food president. So some of it, I think, is the time that we're in. And so when you drop a president like Obama into this place where we're, I think, more excited about food than ever, of course they think Obama's their guy. He's the food guy. I think there's been a lot of disappointments about that because I think people are overly optimistic about what the man's putting in his mouth and the effect it's going to have on this country because it's a big country. But I think a lot of progress has been made. And I know over the weekend at the inauguration parties, there was a lot of talk about food with a lot of important people in the president's team. So I don't know, Ruth can talk a little bit more about that. But
Ruth, we have learned that George Bush and the Bush family also eat organic and local foods. So how is that any different?
Except that they didn't talk about it, which is really odd to me, that here you have people who say that they were eating organic, but they hid it. And that's the point exactly.
Were they afraid that they were going to influence policy if they revealed that? Because that's during the Reagan administration, it turned out that Ronald Reagan only bought or was only fed organically raised cattle for his beef, but his policies were pushing in another direction.
What I think is that they were afraid that they would be seen as elitist and not of the people. And I think that's the point exactly. I mean, there is something shameful about a country which feeds a huge percentage of its children pure junk, stuff that is poison for them, while the president is eating organic food. And he didn't want to, my guess is that he didn't want to be an advocate for it. And he was embarrassed to say, I'm eating so much better than everyone else.
Kim, were you down in Washington for the inauguration?
No, we had my esteemed colleague, Miriam Burrows, on the case, who wrote some dispatches, particularly about one of my favorites was Tom Colicchio saving Joan Nathan's life through a which apparently is now a back, but was not actually the Heimlich.
It was not the Heimlich maneuver. It was a punch in the back to dislodge.
But effective. There
I
a lot
would
of people
never
that,
punch Joan Nathan. I like
if
her
she
too
were
much.
Choking to death, you might.
A lot of people would mind getting punched by Tom Colicchio and have been, as I understand.
But Ruth, you were down there. Were you down there because you wanted to celebrate the inauguration? Many people fought like tooth and nail to be invited. Or was
I was
it
not
because
invited
of the food?
To the inauguration.
Oh, so you were there because of the food things?
I was part of the committee that organized these dinners, which were charity dinners to raise money for food issues in D.C. And there were a number of chefs from all over the country who wanted to come in and be part of this effort and do these dinners, which were in 12 separate houses.
$500 a person.
But most of it went to, actually all of it went to charity.
Martha's Table and D.C. Central Kitchen, also Fresh Farm, an organization that supports farmers markets in the Washington area.
Right.
So two soup kitchens and a farmers market.
Right. And it was, part of what all of us felt was this is a moment when you want to give, you want to do something. You want to celebrate the fact that this new administration is coming in by doing something concrete.
Well, in an article this past Sunday, Jane Black of the Washington Post began by asking, Can the combination of Barack Obama and a $500 a plate meal of grass-fed beef in a rustic guajillo chili sauce and a warm tart of local apples and pears change the world, or at least the way America eats? And she says that the aim of it all was to ignite a conversation about food policy with Obama, a man who actually knows the price of arugula, is at the country's helm. People think, well, they finally see a chance to recast the national debate about food. Was that what inspired you, or that doesn't sound like a bad meal.
Each meal was different. Every chef cooked a completely different meal, and there were different people involved. And
Danya Ballou, Lydia Vascianich, Floyd Cardoz,
Nancy Silverton, Tom Colicchio, Jose Andres.
Dan Barber.
It was an extraordinary group of chefs. And we had done these dinners in New York, and they had been really effective at starting a conversation about what the place of food is in our culture. And if you're someone like me who has seen people care about food, I mean, when I started writing about food, nobody in America cared. And so it's very exciting that people care. And really interesting people came to these meals.
I was impressed with your dining companions. You were just talking about that in the green room a bit ago.
I was seated next to Zeke Emanuel, who is Rahm Emanuel's older brother, a doctor. And
he's the cute one, right?
They're all kind of cute. it's quite a family. There are three of them. One is Ari, the model for the guy in Entourage. Mm-hmm. But Zeke is the doctor and at NIH and, came to the dinner straight from the Obamas. And another person there was the guy who's been in charge of technology for the Obama transition team. So, these are people who actually have some influence. And so to have a conversation and say, how can we change things in this country so that eating great food is not something that just happens for rich people, but that is a prerogative for everyone in the country.
My guests are Ruth Reichel, editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine. She visits us on a regular basis here to talk about food matters. Also, Kim Severson, food writer for The New York Times. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, Jane Black quotes James Thurber, not the great New Yorker writer. He's the director of American University Center of Congressional and Presidential Studies. He said that the problem with this effort is that there's no central core message. Is it about reducing obesity in schools? Is it about pesticides on the farms? It's a wonderful thing, he says, to try to change policy, but what policy are you trying to change? How do you respond to that?
We want to change it all. Who doesn't think that obesity is a problem? And by the way, pesticides are a problem and social justice for farm workers is a problem. And these are all things that need to be changed. And I think that there are many of us who feel that the opportunity is finally within sight.
And I also think that the issue for a lot of people is health. That if you eat better, your health is better, and then you're going to be less of a burden on the healthcare system. And certainly there are enough studies out about Head Start program experiments where they feed children. That's why they have the whole breakfast program. Now, if their bellies are full, they're going to do better in school. And if their bellies are full with food that's not making them fat or giving them pre-diabetic conditions by the time they're 12, well, that's even better. So I think the idea is that good, healthy food that's grown in a way that doesn't exploit the people who have to pick the food and get full of pesticides and that is at a fair price for everybody, that idea, I think, is one that a lot of people can get around in a lot of different ways. And I don't think the idea is that you have one food person saying, this is what we're going to do. I think it's Department of Education has to have food as a, Mayor Bloomberg now has a food czar. So I think this idea that food can have a place at the table in lots of different bureaucracies is what's happening.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. It's not that we think one person, it's not the Secretary of Agriculture alone who's going to make the difference.
Although there have been proposals for a food czar, a national food czar. Michael Pollan has been pushing for that.
You know, it would be great if there were a cabinet-level position, but I don't think most of us think that's going to happen tomorrow. And, you know, for me, just the fact that there's been so much written about this, what good, bad, whatever, the fact that people are talking about it means that it's been successful.
And you make a great point about the cultural impact. You know, what we as a citizen, I have a choice about what I eat every day, and that how I make that choice. I think the president can really affect that. And you made a great point about JFK in a story, for an interview we did.
One of the reasons that people like me really were thinking about the White House chef is because it doesn't have to be approved by Congress. You don't have to have hearings about it. And everybody watches the president. And when JFK stopped wearing hats, it killed the hat industry. So, you know, if I feel like they should have a press office in the White House kitchen that sent out recipes and said, you know, here are three recipes that the Obamas ate last week, and I think it could have a huge impact on what people eat.
So, if, you know, Obama's talking about heirloom, like the White House is serving heirloom apples this week. Well, here are an entire group of people who are going to learn what the heck an heirloom apple is, and some small orchards will get a boost from that. Makes sense.
Well, what do you say to Walter Schreib's defense of the White House chef, the woman who followed him? He says she's not in charge of her destiny, that her job is a service to the First Lady. She should not be telling us what menus she's serving. People shouldn't be beating up on her.
Well, I don't think anybody's beating up on her. The point of the letter we wrote wasn't that we didn't think that she was a great chef or that he was a great chef, but that the position should be rethought, that it should be used as a bully pulpit for good food. And that it's such an easy thing to do, that if you have somebody in that, if you redefine that position so it's not someone who's supposed to not talk about what they're doing, but in fact does say, you know, this is what they're eating in the White House, it could have a profound
impact. Didn't Alice Waters offer you, Danny Meyer, and herself as an informal kitchen cabinet?
She did, as we had hopes that we would get a hearing to talk about changing what the White House chef does.
Have you heard anything from the people in the White House?
Nothing.
I hear they're taking the Jonas Brothers instead of you guys. I don't know.
Well, that has to do with the kids, doesn't it? Kim, there are many food advocates out there with wish lists for Obama. You wrote an article in the Times in December with the headline, "Is a new food policy on Obama's list," saying there are requests for policies on everything from humane treatment of animals to improvement of public school lunches to the return of victory gardens. Do any of those requests seem to be able to get much attention?
Well, I think that obviously it's too soon to tell, and but there were this outpouring of letters that I started seeing, and people were writing, you know, open letter to, and I think it was partly modeled on what Michael Pollan did, his letter to the first farmer, and if you got to imagine that it wasn't just the animal rights folks, and it wasn't just the school food reform people who also wrote their letter, but every other cause. I mean, the environmentalists, everybody else writing their open letter to Obama, and I think the idea is that you forced people to articulate, like you said earlier, you know, what is the central policy here? What is it that people really want? You force groups to articulate what they should, you know, what needs to happen. You force groups of people who had been, you know, perhaps on email links or showing up at conferences to come together to form coalitions and to say this is what we really want. And I think that the administration has listened to that and is listening. And I know that within the USDA itself, I was talking to some folks when I was doing that piece who do programs that are smaller farm-to-table kind of programs. They're helping get fresh vegetables into schools. They're sort of some of the smaller USDA programs that you don't hear a lot about. And there was a big meeting of them, folks who hadn't talked to each other during the Bush administration. They were sort of trying to stay under the radar a little bit. Nobody really knew what anybody else was working on. And here they're starting to come out, you know, come out of the woodwork and say, oh, you're doing that program, I'm doing this. And I think that's really where we're going to see a lot of change because people who are doing these programs feel empowered. And now maybe the guy who's got a farm subsidy, a sustainable farm program in one part of the country will hook up with somebody else who's doing a school food program in another, and they'll start to come together about how USDA funds can make both those programs stronger. That sort of connection, I think, is what's going to happen. I don't think you're going to see those letters answered and they're going to go, you know what, they're absolutely right. We need to have homemade granola in all the schools this morning.
But and this is what happening not just on food, but everybody, every advocacy group in the country is writing to Obama and saying, you know, pay attention to my agenda. And, you know, this is a democracy, and that's what happens when the government changes.
I think it's personal, too, for people in a way that it hasn't been, though. And I, you know, granted, I'm only 15. I'm a young girl. I've not seen that many elections. But I don't recall other transitions where people felt so personal about the food that the guy was eating. I don't know if you've seen this website, the Obama Foodorama website, where every single thing that could possibly, you know, people send in waffles that look like Obama and they post them and they're like, does this mean Obama is going to eat waffles? And then they have, you know, they did an interview with Walter Scheib on there defending. And I just have to point out that Walter Scheib is a great investor. You know, he's got a book to sell. It's important to him, I think, to stay in the mix on this. He's not really involved with the White House anymore. And although I think he's a very smart guy, I do think you have to consider that he does have an agenda when he's defending his hire, Christina, to stay as White House chef. So just in all fairness, let's consider Walter's agenda on some of this. But anyway, I do think that there's just an excitement among foodies, and when I hate that word, but there's an excitement among those who eat about Obama that's personal in a way that hasn't been with any
because
other president.
Michelle Obama says she's concerned about how much high fructose corn syrup her family ingests.
And she said, we're bacon people. Best quote ever.
You like that?
I do. I like them both.
but high fructose corn syrup has been something we've discussed in the past, Ruth,
yes.
as a major problem, one of the causes of obesity in this country.
There's new studies on this, right?
Well, it is. It's, you know, high fructose corn syrup is a very interesting problem. It's not like trans fat where everybody went, you know, this isn't an artificial fat. It really does do strange things in your body and we should get it out. High fructose corn syrup, and Marion Nessel will back, it doesn't really react in your body, they think, all that differently than sugar does, although there's some studies that show that it will increase insulin levels and that can have, you know, and I'm going to get huge letters from the High Fructose Corn Association.
You say there are some studies that suggest that.
Yeah,
that was pretty mealy-mouthed, but I mean, that's what journalists do.
I'm trying to be mealy-mouthed. I get paid to be mealy-mouthed, so there you go. anyway, I think it's questionable. I think the issue is it's so cheap, it allows food to be made inexpensively, and then people can buy a lot of it for not very much money. You know, the food manufacturers like it because it covers up a multitude of sins in the food that is created from flavor and processing. So the thing is, there's so much of it in the diet, and it adds extra calories. That's, I think, what we really know for sure. Whether or not, now there's some studies out about, although I again question those, about the process to make high fructose corn syrup that produces low levels of mercury in some of it. There was a report out today about that. Again, I think that's a little bit questionable, but it's an interesting subject.
But we have talked about how much corn we eat in general. I mean, we eat it through the animal protein because they're all fed corn, and it goes on and on. It seems to be in pretty much everything we eat.
Yeah, I mean,
days.
Michael Pollan basically says if you examine us, we're basically just
take
pure,
a lock of our hair.
Corn. And, you know, that again gets back to the government because it is a heavily subsidized commodity. And we, you know, the part of the problem with the way food is grown in this country is it's not seen as food, it's a commodity. And, you know, it's one of the things that, I mean, ultimately has got to change.
Well, we'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about some of the cabinet appointments like the Department of Agriculture and such, and look into whether that is hopeful in any way. My guests are Ruth Reichel, editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine, and Kim Severson of The New York Times. Stay with us. We're back with Kim Severson of The New York Times and Ruth Reichel, editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine. We're talking about what we might hope for in a new administration in Washington. I gather that any number of people at these events had no idea who Ruth Reichel was, a waitress at one of the dinners on Monday night, said that several guests were asking, who is Alice Waters? Not Ruth Reichel. Who is Alice Waters? Which I thought was another reason to live in New York or at least Berkeley, California. But you have to wonder whether these dinners will have a real impact if people are so out of the loop in terms of the kinds of things you're discussing.
Well, Alice's dinner, I mean, part of what happened was these were all supposed to be very small dinners, and most of them were 20 to 30 people. But the demand for them became so huge that Alice's got larger and larger and larger, so she ended up doing 150 or 200 people before she
really?
Was done. But that was the only one that would have been impossible at any of the small I mean, they were really small, intimate dinners where we were all talking to each other at one big table.
Oh, wow. That's
But to your point about people not knowing who Alice Waters is, and I think it's amazing to watch somebody who starts to get the food thing a little bit. And if you take somebody to a farmer's market, even the most skeptical person, and you shop a little and you buy something and maybe you go home and you cook it together and they start to get the fever, it spreads very quickly. And I think there are a lot of people who just haven't eaten food that tastes that way and haven't kind of seen how it can fit in their life. And once they start to get a little bit of it, it really goes crazy. And then they become insufferable foodies and you can't talk to them after a while. But it's kind of a wonderful thing. And I think that's part of what some of the seed planting was about, was just to get the food in people's mouths. That makes a big difference.
Have you heard of a movement for an organic White House garden called Eat the View, started by Roger Dwaron, the founding director of Kitchen Gardeners International?
I've interviewed him. He's hilarious.
Well,
he's,
actually, we're going to talk to him in just a moment.
Great.
You have to put on the headphones.
And
we have him on the line.
Oh, my God. I'll say hi again. He's great.
We have Roger on the line. Would you put him on? Roger, are you there?
Hi there.
Can you tell us why you think an organic garden at the White House is so important?
Well, I think it's important just because I have one and I am able to kind of experience the benefits and see the benefits of it on a daily basis. I'm approaching this kind of from some different perspectives. One is as a gardener, but another one is as a father. And I just know it's such a good thing for my boys to be able to grow up in close proximity to their food and to have that experience of food as not only a product but a process. And I also know a little bit about history and have seen that the White House grounds have had edibles growing on them over the course of their history. And so it's not so much a new thing that we're talking about, but kind of rediscovering a good old thing.
In fact, it goes back to Thomas Jefferson, but we had FDR with the Victory Garden. Actually, before him, Woodrow Wilson kept sheep on on the White House lawn. Were they there to keep the grass mowed, or were they there because he wanted to have fresh lamb?
Well, I don't think the lamb was the big concern. I think the war was the concern.
So that was World War One. Now and then FDR was World War Two, we are in another war of sorts, aren't we? Is that a reason we should do it now, or should we be doing it for other reasons, Roger?
Well, I think we should be doing it for a whole host of reasons. It's true that at times of crisis, the people have looked to not only the president, but to a certain degree, the White House lawn for a little bit of direction and inspiration. And I think we're at that point again. We are at war, a couple of wars. We're waging a very successful war on the environment at the moment. And people are very concerned about pocketbook issues. And, you know, one thing I tell people is that, you know, gardening does represent a little bit of work, but it comes with its benefits, and those benefits also include financial ones.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that my wife and I, this past growing season, we turned what was already a pretty heroic effort of growing a fair amount of our own food into a more heroic effort by actually weighing every leaf of lettuce that came out of our garden, just because we wanted to get a sense of what the economic value of that was. And in the case of our garden, which is in a very chilly and challenging climate up here in Maine, we calculated that it came out to be about $2,000 worth of organic produce. That's pretty significant for a family.
Thomas Jefferson permanently altered the presidential culinary scene at the White House. He created the Georgetown Farmers Markets, introduced hundreds of varieties of vegetables to America because he had lived in France and discovered that you can really eat well if the ingredients are good. How's your campaign going? Do you think you're going to that this petition you have for organic gardening will actually have some impact?
Well, I think it's already having an important impact in that we're reaching a lot of people. We're getting a lot of good feedback from people. You know, we were talking a little bit before, you were talking before about, you know, some of the dangers of elitism in the food movement. And I think gardens are a way of kind of democratizing the food movement. This is something that so many people could do.
Absolutely. And if you have the president doing it again, it's like Kennedy in the hat. If the Obamas put in a garden, people all over America would put in gardens, and they would probably put in the same garden that the Obamas did.
And I don't think politically at this point the Obamas having a garden that they enjoy, a public garden, and growing food is going to be any kind of an insult to the larger agricultural interests. I don't think it's going to screw up Obama's political life at all. I think there may have been a time in which that would have been seen as an aggressive move or a statement about Obama, the president's attitude toward large agricultural interests. But now I think, you know, the gardening movement, it's really happening. A lot of people are doing gardens now. It's quite the thing. And I think it really would have a big impact.
Now, Roger, do you know if the Obama administration is aware of your campaign?
They're certainly aware of it. I've had swapped emails with a staff member of Michelle Obama's staff. So they certainly are aware that we're out there. I haven't had anything that I could qualify as kind of positive feedback, but there's definitely recognition, and we're excited. We just think that this is an idea that has come again, and I wouldn't be doing this if it was just about a single garden. As much as I admire the Obamas and want them to eat well, you know, I'm doing this because I think we're talking about millions of gardens with this project.
Have you talked to Alice? Have you guys joined together in your garden campaign?
We have been in touch, and Alice Waters has been such an important figure in this issue, and she's been very kind to provide us with a very supportive testimonial for our website, as have a number of other well-known people in the food world. So we certainly have the support of those people, but I think what it really will come down to is just having the support of so many gardeners and so many parents who want their children to be eating high-quality foods. That's really what's going to win this at the end of the day.
Now, Roger, I pronounced your name. I gave you your last name, the French pronunciation. I've heard it pronounced both ways, Waron and Doiron. How do you pronounce it?
Well, we pronounce it in our house, actually, the French way, Doiron, because my wife is French-speaking Belgian, and we try to speak French at the house. But the American version that people often use here is Doiron.
Doiron. Well, Roger Doiron, whatever, thank you so much for talking with us.
I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
And I'm in the same room with Kim Severson of the New York Times and Ruth Reichel, editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine. We're talking about what we might hope will happen during the Obama administration in regard to food. So what about the some of the choices, for example, the appointments to the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Education? Do you see them as hopeful?
I do. I am, I am among the people who says, you know, I think we have to wait and see. Vilsack is...
Tom Vilsack, the new Secretary of Agriculture, is the former governor of Iowa. He
has
been friends, but he's also been friends with big agriculture and a big supporter of Monsanto. And those are things that those are words that drive foodies crazy, aren't they?
They are, but it's a half full or half empty kind of situation, because he's also been very good on a lot of environmental things, and there's a lot to be optimistic about with him. And I think we just have to wait and see.
And I think also that position is important, but I think there are undersecretaries and there are other appointments that might be almost as important in a way. And I know there's a group out there now, Food Democracy Now, a fellow named David Murphy, who's putting together a petition and a list of what he calls his sustainable dozen, which are people that he wants to see placed. He and 80,000 other people have signed his petition, want to see placed. He was pushing for someone other than Vilsack for agriculture secretary. And when that didn't happen, he just sort of picked himself up and dusted himself off and started to aim for undersecretary positions. So I think those positions will have a larger impact than the head honcho in some ways.
And Food Democracy Now! Is a nonprofit that was also begun by Nyman Ranch founder Paul Willis.
And it's based in Iowa. It's kind of interesting that some of the strongest food advocates in the country right now are out of Iowa, like Vilsack. They really know big agriculture from the ground up. I think that's an interesting point.
There is a real concern now because the average age of a farmer in this country is around 60 years old. Less than 5% of the farmers are under 35. We have to wonder what's going to happen in the future.
Well, unless we change policy, that's why so many of us were so disappointed about the last farm bill, because we had hopes that it would support small family farms, which there are a lot of kids now who want to go into small family farming, and they could use, it's difficult. It's really hard work.
Well, Barry Esterbrook wrote on gourmet.com that Nyman Ranch is out of cash. And now Nyman Ranch is a pretty famous food supplier. What does that mean?
Well, there are companies all over the country that are running out of cash.
But I think Nyman Ranch is kind of a unique case in that, well, not unique, but like many companies that start out with small, great ideas, and I think you probably were there and watched Bill Nyman and Orville Schell start driving the beef around in their truck back in the day. Like Celestial Seasoning, like many other small companies, they got larger, they got absorbed, I think maybe a year now, maybe it's been 2 years. Bill Nyman himself was sort of, they took on debt, they took on investors, he left the company. It's just sort of the natural cycle of business. I think what you have replacing it are people like Flying Pig Farms. You have lots of small meat producers who are doing the work that Bill Nyman
And Bill Nyman himself is now
created.
Raising goats and has another company. So
I don't think you can read.
Maybe we'll see some goats on the White House lawn.
I like a good goat. Now, that would be fantastic, I think.
And that could also recycle all the garbage.
And save money on gardeners. So I think that really it's win-win with the goats.
Tom,
I'm
going to
start a website, Goats for the Garden, Goats for the White House. Put a goat in the White House.
Tom, we've had old goats in the White House many times. Tom Vilsack said that one of his top priorities for today was a meeting on civil rights. The Department of Agriculture has been embroiled in a long-running dispute over its handling of complaints of black farmers. So that would suggest there are other aspects to the Department of Agriculture that we normally don't even think about.
Well, it's a huge department that covers all kinds of things that are sort of stunning.
There were people who fantasized Michael Pollan being named the head of the Department of Agriculture. Would that have been possible?
It would have been the biggest disaster in the history of the world, in my opinion, only because Michael is like, we talked about this. He's the, this is a huge job that has a huge budget and thousands and thousands of employees. And
you need someone who knows how to negotiate Washington. You can't just put some novice into a high profile job in Washington. You have to have somebody who is, seriously political.
But I do think that movement, and I did buy a Michael Pollan for Ag Secretary onesie for my child, because this is just, it's a classic, I think. She only wears it, in the house, so I don't want to be biased or anything.
But, you don't want Ruth to see her in it.
No. But I do think the idea that we could have that kind of person as a leader in the government opened up the whole flood that followed. So I think that from a, ideological perspective, it was a really kind of brilliant little campaign that, although the folks who were pushing him, I wrote in the Times a couple of stories and talked and quoted Michael saying this would be the most ridiculous thing ever, and I don't know what they're thinking, and I think I called it a sort of an ill-conceived idea, and they were on me worse than the high fructose corn syrup people
really?
Are about to be on me. They were like, this is very serious. We really believe that he can be, it was hilarious. So they were very sincere backing for Michael to be ag secretary.
And it would be a disaster for us to lose him as a critic, because he's really important.
I'm going to predict that things will improve as far as foodies are concerned, but they're going to be very disappointed nonetheless. My great thanks to my two guests today, Kim Severson of the New York Times, Ruth Reichel, editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine. It's been a lot of fun, as always, Ruth. And it's great meeting you, Kim.
Yeah, I look forward to meeting you some more.